Conduct himself in this life when it comes to civil affairs and rulers. He gives you key instructions on how you should avoid difficulties and problems. He says he's observed in this life that the foolish are sometimes exalted, and that the honorable are sometimes debased. So here again, it's that upside downness, if you will, of what is in the world that we see as a reality. And the practicability use of wisdom. Wisdom has practical uses. If you apply wisdom, then you're going to always come out better than the fool. And then he ends the chapter with saying, do not curse the king. And so these are the principal things that we'll be discussing in chapter 10. And chapter 10 is written somewhat like the Proverbs. So they kind of one or two verses clump together in a thought, and then they move to another thought. Verse 1 says, dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So does a little folly hinder the reputation for wisdom and honor. That's kind of an interesting way of putting it. You know, dead flies causes the perfumer's mixture to stink. Well, you know how it's also bad for barbecues. You can't keep those flies off. It irritates you. It makes you feel really uncomfortable that you got all these flies. I know when back in Honduras, they have open meat markets, and they'll have animals they slaughtered that morning on the table out there in the sun, and they're just covered with flies. They don't even try to shoo them off. That's one reason why when you cook meat in Honduras, you cook it well. You don't have medium rare. Everything's cooked, you know, down to almost charcoal because of the lack of sanity. But flies are a nasty thing. It causes us to feel uncomfortable. Well, it causes stink. Same thing it says that folly in a man who is by reputation wise and honorable. You know, you have a man who is honest, straightforward, a straight shooter, and then he does one little thing, can undo so much good. In verse 2 he says, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left. As a right hand is ordinarily the hand most people use. This is a generalization, of course. Nothing is left of people. But almost everybody's right-handed. And the right hand is the hand that typically is stronger. It is more exercised. It's more ready to be used when you need it than the left hand is. What else do you know about the left and right hand? Well, the right hand commands, a man who commands his right hand is a wise man. He has control over his own mind, his own feelings, his own passions, his self-control, which he also uses to conduct his life. He's a man that walks circumspectly as a wise man, not like a fool. On the contrast of that, the fool has no restraint on his passions and no rule over his tongue. He just kind of lets life come as it will, and he does whatever seems at the time proper. In Scripture, right hand and left hand are referred to as good and evil. Who in judgment wants to be on the left hand? None of us. We all want to be on the right hand. Why? Because that's where the sheep are. And so through the Scripture, God uses that left hand, right hand analogy several times to demonstrate a man who is proper and right, as opposed to a man that is not. The wise man is always employed in doing good, whereas the fool is almost always employed in doing nonsense and evil. And so, the wise man's heart is at his right hand, but the fool's heart is at his left. Philippians 3:17, brethren, be followers together with me, and mark them which walk so as you have us for an example. For those who do not walk according to that example their end is destruction, and whose God is their belly. When it says their God is their belly, what's he talking about? He's talking about earthly appetite. Their God is whatever makes them happy. It could be the accumulation of wealth. It could be drunkenness. It can be drugs. It can be anything that makes them happy. Immorality. Verse 3 says, yea, also, when he that is a fool walks by the way, his wisdom fails him, and he shows everyone that he's a fool. A fool, as he walks, every aspect of his life, around his friends, this irreligious man shows that what kind of man he is. You know what kind of person a person is by how they conduct themselves. By their fruits you shall know them. And so everybody can see the kind of life that you live. It says vanity and nonsense and wickedness are the themes of his life. And also in effect he's saying to all that he's a fool. He's a shallow, self-serving, self-interested person. Every moment he occupied with pleasure and vanity. Men that are foolish in this world strive after the wind. Remember in vanity, vanity is all is vanity. And a vexation of the spirit. Well, that vexation of the spirit is a striving after the wind. Wanting to find pleasure, wanting to find purpose, wanting to find meaning in your life and things that you can see and obtain. Foolish men. Genesis 6. You know the condition of mankind. Every thought and imagination of man's heart was evil and that continually. Now, we all want to believe that there's good folks out there, but that's not really true. But we know, because God wrote it, that it is true. And not only do we know it's true in Genesis chapter 6, it's true largely today. Man's hearts and their imaginations is always trying to devise some new thing. And most of the time, they're trying to invent things that are not good. Other ways to get more pleasure, more enjoyment out of life, as opposed to serving and worshiping God. Verse 4, he says that if the spirit of a ruler rise up against you, leave not your place, for yielding pacifies great offense. We all know that. If a person comes across a situation and somebody gets killed and they run off, they don't hang around to tell what they saw or what they're more subject to being a suspect in the crime than if they'd stayed put. When you flee, what you're really saying is you look guilty. Because guilty people are the ones that run and hide. People that have nothing to be guilty of or afraid of don't need to run. So he's saying if the ruler rises up against you, don't leave your place. Because if you take off and go to another country, he's going to assume what he's been hearing about you is true. One should humble oneself and show respect to the one in charge. Once you have demonstrated humility, the judge is more ready to hear your defense. If you go into a court of law and you try to explain to the judge why that cop was wrong and why you really didn't deserve this ticket, all of your defense goes out the window. If you go in and own up to the crime you committed, or at least own up to the fact that the officer had a legitimate right to write you a ticket, that he misunderstood the situation, I was on my way to the hospital, whatever is your defense, then the judge is more willing to hear. Same thing is true in any court of law. A person needs to be respectful of authority. If you notice when Stephen was being stoned, he didn't rail against those people. He didn't say, you know, how filthy and nasty and mean-hearted they were. He complimented him. We're all children of Abraham. We're all of the same stock. We all believed in Moses. And he worked his magic, if you will, and for quite a long ways, they listened carefully to what he was saying until they got to the punchline, which says, "But our fathers murdered all the prophets." Now, they couldn't deny that. They knew that was the truth, but it didn't set well with them. And so they shut their ears. Verse 5, 6, and 7 all talk about the same thing. There is an evil which I've seen under the sun. It's an error which proceeds from the ruler. While he is set in great dignity and the rich set in low places. I've seen servants upon horses and princes walking upon the ground. So Solomon says that he's seen this evil under the sun, and it's an error of the ruler. What kind of error is he talking about? What error has the ruler done? Well, let's consider Mordecai. Everybody hopefully knows about Mordecai from the book of Esther. The king had promoted to a high place of honor and power Haman. Was that a wise decision on the king's part? It certainly was not. The king made an error in judgment. He put a man in charge and overseeing of the realm who was an arrogant, prideful, self-serving individual, which is evident from the story that you read in Esther. You haven't read that lately? Go back and read it. It's an excellent story, and it shows a lot about both the affairs of the world that we're talking about here in Ecclesiastes, but also shows a lot about the working of God. Because in that book, God's never even mentioned. And yet, you can see his hand through the whole book. Haman wanted to murder Mordecai because he wouldn't bow down. Hurt his ego and it made him angry. And not only did he want to murder Mordecai because he wouldn't bow down to him, which is silly in its very self, but he wanted to murder everybody who was related to Mordecai. In fact, he wanted to murder all the Jews, the entire nation of people, all because this man had the gall of not bowing down and showing homage to him. And so you have a perfect example of a king who made a tragic mistake. Now, he corrected it in time, but that's the kind of folly that kings do. How many times have people been appointed to an office to later find that, well, they were embezzling money? Government is riddled with that type of individuals. Politicians go to Washington. You see a new congressman elected, never been in Congress before. He goes up there with starry eyes and great ideas, and he's going to solve America's problems. And he's not there but 6 months, a year. And what happens to him? Well, he gets corrupted like all the rest of the people. He has to start making compromises. And when a man of integrity starts making compromises, he begins to lose his own self-direction of where he needs to be going. And so it is in our government. Ecclesiastes talks about earlier, where he says, do not be surprised when you see injustice. And I worked late last night, folks, you might know that. He says, when you see oppression of the poor and violent perverting of judgment, you shouldn't be surprised. That's the norm in our world. He talks about how a bribe destroys the heart. You have people who are making $100,000 a year living in a $3 million house. Something's not right about that. Now, I'm not saying they did anything legally wrong, but morally, you got to wonder, why are they serving the people? Is it to serve the people, or is it to actually serve themselves? verse 8 and 9 says, he that digs a pit shall fall into it, and whosoever breaks a hedge, a serpent will bite him. Verse 9, whoso removes stones shall be hurt therewith, and he that cleaves wood shall be endangered thereby. So what is Solomon telling you that he's already told you, and making a point of? What does that tell you? A man's occupation is digging ditches. Or building stone structures. And those occupations are risk and dangers, are they not? Certainly they are. When I was younger, I used to be a marine agent for the federal government, the Sea Grant program, and I'd go out on shrimping boats. And you know what I observed about shrimping boats? That they all had a captain, and almost without fail, every shrimping boat captain didn't have 10 digits anymore, because they have a wheel that turns constantly, and to pull that big net out of the ocean, they take a big rope and they wrap it around that thing, and they feed that rope, and it pulls the net in. And invariably, if you're not careful, their finger will get stuck between that roller and that rope, and you just get cut right off. Almost all of them were missing one or more fingers because of the danger associated with that type of occupation. So what is Solomon saying? What is the thing you should have learned last week? See, little test. Y'all won't hear it. I don't know. What should we have learned last week? What would we discuss that is relevant to this point? I'll give you a second to contemplate it. No takers. Back earlier, he has already told us, time and chance happens to us all. When you're in occupation, you got to be careful. Why? Because accidents can and do happen. And so, if you're in these occupations, it's to be expected, if you're not careful, that you will injure yourself in the occupation you chose, because time and chance happens to everybody. You trip and you fall. Verse 10, he says, if an axe is blunt and it is not sharpened the edge, then must he put more strength. But wisdom is profitable to direct. And so, and if you ever use an axe, you know after you chopped on that tree for a while, that axe blade gets dull. And if you sharpen it, then you can go right through the tree. Otherwise, you've got to really swing that sucker hard. Wisdom allows you to understand the mechanics of what's going on. It directs you in the care of your equipment and your tools, and thereby relieves you of the strain and the waste of time and effort that you go through sometimes in the occupations you choose because you didn't use common sense. A man with wisdom knows how to take care of his tools. Thus the saying, work smarter, not harder, is a very true statement. A lot of people work really hard because they don't work very smart. Foolish man wastes time and resources. Now, if you folks don't speak up, we're going to have an abridged study. I worry about that going into this because these points are not hard, and they're fairly quick. You can go through them, but you can go through them too fast, and I don't want to pass up anything that really needs to be said about what he's really talking about is applying. When he says wisdom, he's not talking about necessarily book learning. What he's talking about is an understanding, a grasp of that which should be logically and orchestrated. My dad used to have, when he was alive, all his tools laid out just perfectly. And if I used his hammer, right, George, I put that hammer back where it belonged. I could never teach my boys that. For some reason, they use the hammer, they leave it in the dirt. I had to go around behind them picking all the stuff up. But wise people take care of their things. They've organized themselves. Verse 11 says, surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and the babbler is no better. A serpent will bite without enchantment. So is he talking about serpents? Is that what he's trying to warn you about? Is be careful, don't get bit by a snake. No, he ain't talking about snakes. Snakes ain't the point. But snakes illustrate the point. What is the point? Babblers. Who is a babbler?
People that talk without.
People just rattle on and on and on. Instead, my youngest son, I always joking with him, you babbling, boy. You spent 5-10 minutes talking to me and you haven't said anything. Just foolish rattling. Well, that's not a good trait to be in. Babblers are people who are perceived by God to be those which have no control over their tongue. And we know from James that a man who doesn't control his tongue is subject to mishaps that will lead to him into sin. James says, even so the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. Behold how great a matter a little fire kindles. Controlling the tongue is a essential part of being a wise man. Putting yourself into a position where you're contemplating, you think carefully before you go running off at the mouth. And yet a babbler just blurts out whatever's in his head without consideration of what it really does and what he's really saying. Psalms 58 says their poison is like the poison of a serpent. Men use their tongue to tear down, to destroy. It's amazing how words have such power. In fact, in the beginning, God spoke the world into existence. Words are powerful things. And yet, so often, we don't pay heed to what we say. And once you say it, no matter how hard you want to suck it back, it's out there, folks. It doesn't ever come back. Verse 12 says, the words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of the fool will swallow him up. The words of the wise man's mouth. What does it mean the words of a wise man's mouth is gracious? This is not that hard, folks.
A wise man knows when to keep his mouth shut.
One thing, in first chapter 3, he says, there's a time to speak and a time to be silent. Sometimes we really need to work on that time to be silent. Colossians 4 says, walk in wisdom toward them that are without, redeeming the time. There is a man who's wise. It says, walk circumspectly, redeeming the time. Let your speech always with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer other men. What does it mean to have speech that is filled with grace? It's like salt. What do you use salt for?
To preserve.
To preserve. To give a pleasant taste. That's how our speech should be. We should be speaking words that are encouraging. Words that lift up. Far too often people speak words that are hurtful, that are mean-spirited, that have come out of a heart of jealousy, envy, strife. A babbler is that type of individual, a talebearer, if you will. The words of the fool are poorly thought out. He engages his mind or his mouth before he engages his mind. And invariably, when you let your mouth run ahead of your mind, what you're going to be wishing is you hadn't said that. Now, Jody Reed's been guilty of that before. I've had to go back and tell folks, you know, I was totally out of line. Why? Well, because I let my mouth run off before I put my mind in gear. We need to always be looking at how we can build one another up. And God expects us to do that. Verse 13, the beginning of the words of his mouth are foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness. A fool, a babbler, a man who has no control of his tongue is a man which is going to cause mischief. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later, about talebearers, gossiping. Think about that. You know, where do we get the sin of gossiping? Well, it comes from us using our tongue inappropriately, saying that which should not have been said. Not necessarily lying, it may be true, but does it need to be said? Just because something's true doesn't mean that you have to say it. Sometimes you need to learn to be silent. Verse 14 says, a fool also is full of words. A man cannot tell what should be after him. Who can tell him? Now, the ending of that verse goes back to the same thing. A foolish man thinks he knows everything. And you met people like that, I'm sure. They know everything. You can ask them any question about any subject, and they got an opinion about that. And they'll get that opinion as if it's, you know, the gospel, without any conscious thought of what they're really even saying. Because no man can predict or tell what's going to be. And no man knows the spirit of another man except that man whose spirit it is. Which means that if you go talking about Brother so-and-so, your perception of what happened may be totally and completely erroneous. You may think it's true, but doesn't make it true. A fool is full of words. He didn't mind sharing them either. Chapter 5, verse 3, the fool's voice is known by a multitude of words. A man who babbles on and on. My dad was a man of very few words. And that's just the way he was. He just didn't, he was not a talker like his son. I could talk your ear off. My dad didn't hardly talk at all. In fact, we'd go out fishing sometime, 8-9 hours in that boat, and that man probably wouldn't say 4 words to me. Yeah. You hung up again? That's all they ever said. In the end of his life, the last few months, probably because of the medication he's on, he and I had a lot of good conversations. But up until then, that man didn't hardly say anything to anybody. But when he did say something, people paid attention. And so it was that he was a man who was respected, not because he thought he knew everything, but because when he said something, he had thought it out, and people understood that that's probably a pretty wise thought. Chapter 3, 22, 6, 12, 9, 12, and now in 10, 14, Solomon goes back to that same old refrain, who can tell a man what is going to be after him? Who can tell him? No one can tell him. No one knows not only what's on tomorrow, but no one knows what's in the next 5 minutes. You live your life minute by minute, and that's just the way God has intended. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. It says, the labor of a foolish man wearies every one of them because they know not how to get to the city. A foolish man is poorly prepared, lacking of understanding, and therefore he doesn't even understand that all the work he's doing is vain and unprofitable. I don't care how important you think your job is, in the scheme of eternity, it is not of any value at all. It's vanity. That's the reason he came up with the premise at the very beginning. Vanity, vanity, all is truly vanity. Why? Because as you walk along the beach, you leave footprints. But as the first wave washes over, the footprint gets less visible. by the second wave, it's gone all together. And there's no remembrance of anything that was done. He says, woe to the old land when the king is a child and the prince when he eats in the morning. But blessed is the land when the king is a son of nobles and the prince is eating in due season for strength and not for drunkenness. What's he comparing in those verses? What is the point he's really making? And when you analyze these verses, when you think about them, you need to keep in back of your mind always, what is the purpose of writing the book to begin with? So what's he really comparing here? Well, he's comparing a child versus a son. Those two terms are used to denote two types of people. What do you think when you think of a child? That's mine. I don't want that. All Stephazor, all they want is for their own benefit, for their own pleasure. They do foolish and silly things. They say hateful things. They can be mean-spirited. Children can be vicious. If you don't think so, go back to elementary school. The kind of things that children can say to one another are extremely harsh. You know, as they get older, they kind of learn that even if her hair looks stupid, you don't say that. You can think it, but you don't come out and say, well, your hair looks stupid because you hurt somebody's feelings. But the son of nobles, someone who is in a position of responsibility, who takes his job seriously, who's not looking out for his own good. Think about Solomon when he began his reign. He was a young man. What was his concern? Lord, how am I going to rule this great people? In humility, he was consciously striving to find a correct path for the betterment of God's children. So many kings weren't like that. You go through the entire book of 1 and 2 Kings, you'll find multiple times when kings came to the throne. Well, Josiah, I think, is the youngest one I know of. He's 8 years old. But you have numbers of them that were in their teenage years that come to the throne, and so many of them were foolish, like Rehoboam. Now, Rehoboam wasn't that young, but he certainly was a fool and self-serving. So he contrasts the king as a child with the king of nobles. And he says, you know, you're blessed. The land is blessed. People are blessed when you have a king that is wise and conscious of his responsibilities. You basically have a curse if your king is a fool. Verse 18, by much slothfulness the building decays, and through idleness of the hands the house drops through. That's a proverb, basically right out of the book of Proverbs, clearly. In fact, Proverbs 24 said, I went by the field of the slothful, the lazy man, and by the vineyard of a man void of understanding. And lo, it was grown over with thorns and thistles and covered his face thereof, and his stone wall had broken down. If you know anything at all about the affairs of this world, you have to maintain things. We maintain our bodies. We brush our teeth, we cut our hair, we take care of ourselves. And if you don't do those things, what happens to you? Well, you begin to look like the guy out there in the street who has no bathroom to shower in, doesn't have the essentials to take care of his body. And you can tell he's a ragged, rough individual. Houses, look at houses up and down the highway that have been there for a long time. The roofs are caving in. It takes work and effort to maintain your things. And a lazy man will not accomplish the things that he needs to accomplish for his own benefit and for the benefit of society. Verse 19, the feast is made for laughter and wine makes merry, but money answers all things. That's a little tough to try to get your handle around. But when he talks about feast is made for laughter and wine for merry, he's talking about people who search after pleasure. But he has already said back in chapter 7, verse 12, excuse me, Wisdom is a defense and money is a defense, but the excellency of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to them that have it. Money is profitable. It is the answer to a lot of people's problems, but it needs to be used wisely. A man who does not use his money wisely is a foolish man and is destined to be poor. Proverbs 3 says, wisdom is a tree of life to them that lay hold upon her. Happy is everyone that retains her. Somebody that is sober-minded, wise in his understanding. In the last verse, curse not the king, not in thy bedchamber, for the bird of the air will carry the voice, and that which he brings will tell the matter. Be sure, if you say something about somebody, eventually it will get back to him. And so he says, do not even think in your mind of a curse of the king. Why? Because if you think in your mind, law will come out your tongue. If it comes out your tongue, somebody's going to repeat it to the king, and you're going to be in trouble. Anybody got any comments? We have come to the bell. Okay, folks, if not, I'll give the class to you.